most effectively.
LeBlanc made a harsh, disgusted sound, but Murakuma shook her head.
I don't blame him. I'm the commander on the spot, and making decisions like that comes with the job.
With all due respect, Waldeck began hotly, you've got enough on your shoulders fighting the damn battle without having to accept res—
I said I don't blame him, Demosthenes,
Murakuma said flatly.
He closed his mouth with a snap, and she smiled more naturally and squared her shoulders. At least knowing what we now do simplifies our priorities, gentlemen. Leroy, I want you and Tian to get with Commodore Reichman and his staff as soon as his transports return from Sarasota. We have to establish hard guidelines on who we evacuate and in what order. We'll begin with minor children and pregnant women. Whenever possible in two-parent families, I want one parent included as well. After that, we go with second parents and the elderly.
The elderly, sir?
McKenna asked with a careful lack of expression.
And Murakuma smiled bitterly.
She knew what he wasn't saying, and what someone else most assuredly would. The elderly, after all, had already lived full lives and had less to contribute to the war effort. She loathed the people who could make that argument, but they existed, and whatever she decided would be wrong in their eyes. How would it feel, she wondered mordantly, when they started calling her a monster and a coward for saving herself by abandoning civilians to their fate? The elderly, she repeated, trying and failing to hide her pain. We owe them that, and their age will make them more of a liability for the people we can't get out.
A liability in what way, sir?
LeBlanc asked. There are no non-combatants in this war, Marcus.
Murakuma's voice went harsh.
Admiral Eusebio is stripping Sarasota of infantry weapons and sending them up with Reichman. He'll drop them off at Justin, and while Leroy and Tian are conferring with the Commodore on ship movements, you, Marcus, are going to be working with General Servais on deployment plans for Marine garrisons on Justin, Harrison, and Clements.
Garrisons?
Waldeck looked at her in disbelief, and she raised an eyebrow. The other admiral hesitated for a moment, then gripped the nettle.
Sir, Vanessa, if we can't keep the enemy from taking the system, how can we possibly justify sending in ground troops? Once the enemy controls the high orbitals, they'll be in a death trap.
We aren't justifying it. I am,
Murakuma said flatly.
Everyone else on those planets will already be in a death trap unless we can somehow fight our way back in. We can't fool ourselves here, Demosthenes. These creatures don't distinguish between military personnel and civilians. Anyone we leave behind won't just be killed. They're going to be eaten, and I will not simply abandon them. We may not be able to save them, but we can at least give them the weapons and advisors to make the bastards pay for them. Flaming green eyes pinned her subordinates in their chairs, and her voice was a sliver of soprano ice. This war is going to be for survival, worse than ISW3 ever was. We've grown out of the habit of thinking that way. But this, she slammed the heel of her hand on the data chip, says we damn well better remember how. And gentlemen, starting right here, right now, we are going to teach these fucking monsters humans don't come cheap.
Chapter 7. To Face the Hurricane.
The Admiral is on the bridge.
Officers looked up, but Murakuma's wave sent them back to their tasks as she crossed to her command chair, settled into it,
and fiddled with her plot's contrast controls. She adjusted it to her satisfaction, then looked up and beckoned to Commander Ling, and the ops officer gathered up her memo pad and crossed to her side. Good afternoon, Admiral.
The commander was 10 centimeters shorter than Murakuma, but she was also a native of Old Terra, one of the very few native Terrans, relatively speaking, in TF-59.
And for all her petite slenderness, she looked almost stocky beside the taller admiral.
Tian, Murakuma acknowledged,
then pointed at the memo pad. Did you and Admiral Teller reach the same conclusions I did?
Yes, sir.
Ling set the pad on Murakuma's console and switched it on.
Its tiny hollow unit projected its display before the admiral, and Ling highlighted a block of characters in amber.
You were right, she said. Akagi, Bunker Hill, Cabot, Emperor, and Kuznetsov didn't want to admit it, but analysis of their operations indicates pilot fatigue's become a definite problem for them.
Not surprising, Murakuma murmured, studying the numbers.
Sarasota had been able to make good the enormous hardware losses of Jackson Teller's strike groups by sending forward every reserve fighter in inventory, but Admiral Eusebio had been unable to replace their dead flight crews. It was a hellish choice, for Sarasota depended heavily on fighters for its own defense, and Eusebio could, in fact, have brought Teller's groups back up to strength, but only by sending up enough pilots to critically reduce his own capabilities. As it was, the fleet base's squadrons were at barely 60% strength, and he refused to deplete them still further.
Murakuma couldn't fault him for that.
What had happened in Erebor was grim proof of the sort of casualties TF-59 might suffer, and if that happened, Eusebio's fighters were all he'd have. But understanding made her own problems no less pressing, and she frowned at the uncaring numbers. Teller's staff had done its best to redistribute its available pilots, but fighter squadrons were intricately meshed organisms whose members worked together almost as much by instinct as order. Breaking them up or introducing newcomers, however well trained, degraded effectiveness until the replacements had time to settle in, and no one knew how much time they had. They knew only that TF-59 would be heavily outnumbered when the time came, and the Federation's apparent monopoly on the strike fighter made those fighter groups pearls beyond price. They had to be as efficient and deadly as possible, so Teller, with her approval, had left the groups of the four newly arrived carriers untouched, and mixed and matched to rebuild those of the Erebor survivors as best he could. They had sufficient personnel to operate all their fighters, but fighter ops were the most physically demanding duty the TFN offered.
They were also among the most dangerous, as Vanessa Murakuma knew only too well, for Lieutenant Tadayoshi Murakuma had died on routine ops exactly 3 days after their second daughter was born.
But it was the fatigue factor which worried her now. A carrier normally carried twice as many crews as fighters, so it could rotate its personnel. But the groups of the five carriers Ling had listed were at barely 42% strength, and most were scratch-built out of bits and pieces from Sarasota after the complete replacement squadrons had been distributed to other ships. The strain of shaking down as combat-capable entities while simultaneously pulling their weight in TF-59's routine patrols showed, and pilot fatigue was rising rapidly towards unacceptable levels. "All right," she said finally. "I want those groups stood down for at least 48 hours. Have Admiral Teller redistribute patrol assignments to adjust. Once they've had a couple of days to recuperate, he can reintegrate them. But I want his primary emphasis to be on getting them shaken down, not scouting duties. After all," she smiled thinly, "we know where the enemy will be coming from." "Yes, sir."
Ling tapped a note into the memo pad, and Murakuma crossed her legs.
"The mine layers completed their operations on schedule." "Yes, sir." Ling's reply was as calm as ever,
and Murakuma surprised herself with a brief chuckle. She'd been an ops officer herself, and Tian's unflagging courtesy couldn't fool her. The commander didn't have to say, "of course," for Murakuma to hear it. Ling arched a graceful eyebrow, but Murakuma only shook her head.
Bad enough that she was fretting over routine details without admitting she knew she was. "That's all for now, Tian," was all she said, and smiled fondly at the commander's back as Ling returned to her station. Then her smile faded, and she steepled her fingers under her chin as she gazed back down at her icon-frosted plot. Classic warp point defense doctrine was to hit the enemy as he made transit, in the old wet navy equivalent of catching him as he emerged one ship at a time from a narrow strait. 60 years ago, before the Theban War, the defender's advantage had been so crushing the mere thought of a full-scale warp point assault could turn any admiral gray. But the pendulum had shifted in the attacker's favor with the SBM Hawk. The warp-capable missile pods were expensive, both to build and in terms of freighter lift, but enough of them could gut any close-in defense, as Ivan Antonov had proved almost exactly 59 years before at the Fourth Battle of Lorelei. But this enemy didn't seem to have SBM Hawks, which made a close defense far more appealing, or would have, without his assault fleet.
Murakuma couldn't afford to expose her lighter battle line to a mass simultaneous transit that was almost certain to enjoy the advantage of surprise, however briefly.
Even light cruisers could tear battleships apart if enough of them caught the capital ships when they weren't at battle stations. Yet she did have one huge advantage Villiers had been denied in Erebor. The mine layers had emplaced every antimatter mine and laser buoy Sarasota could scrape up around the enemy's entry warp point.
There weren't as many as Murakuma could have wished, and neither mines nor buoys could be placed directly atop an open warp point,
since the grav tides of an open point would suck in and destroy anything that small. But they could be placed around the point, and Ling's patient report confirmed that hundreds of them had been. No doubt most of the single-shot buoys would expend themselves on the simultaneous transit rather than its betters, but the mines behind them should at least pen the big boys up until they could be cleared. It was tempting to hold her full force, or at least the ones armed with strategic bombardment missiles, in range to batter them while they fought to break through the mines, but the enemy would have an enormous advantage in launchers, and the fact that he hadn't used the extended-range SBMs yet didn't prove he didn't have them. Worse, Sarasota's R&D staff still couldn't give her a definitive estimate on the range of those damned plasma guns. She dared not assume their envelope was as tight as R&D thought it was, and even if it was, they knew the enemy had the capital force beam. Add capital missiles from his missile-heavy SDs, and sheer volume of fire would quickly cripple her lighter battleships if she met him head-on. No, she told herself again. A conventional defense was out of the question. She had to concede the warp point. Bleed them on it, yes, but let them have it, and make it a running fight in deep space, where her speed and tech advantages could be exploited to the maximum. If she'd had any chance at all of stopping them dead, she would have accepted the losses of a close defense to do it. But she didn't. All she could do was mount a fighting retreat that inflicted the maximum attrition, and pray the people trapped in Meriwether, when she finally withdrew, wouldn't haunt her dreams with the horror she knew they would.
All right, Marcus, give me the bad news.
Captain LeBlanc sighed.
His recliner was cocked back at a comfortable angle. One hand held a tall iced drink, and he'd kicked his boots off, something he never would have done if anyone else were present. But his eyes belied his relaxed posture.
"It's not good, Vanessa," he admitted. "Commodore Reichman's working wonders, but it's going to take at least 6 more round trips to get everyone out."
"What if we detached our destroyers?"
She leaned forward in her own chair, left hand squeezing the fingers of her right.
"The Johnstons are too small to be really combat effective, and—"
"Vanessa," LeBlanc interrupted her more firmly than a captain should interrupt an admiral, and she looked up from her hands.
"It wouldn't matter," he said. "They don't have enough life support to make any difference. Even if you let Reichman have all 7 of them, they couldn't squeeze more than 2,000 people aboard."
"But—"
Murakuma chopped herself off, then sighed and rubbed her face with her palms.
"You're right."
Her hands muffled her voice, but he heard the pain in it.
"I'm dithering, aren't I?"
"In a word," he said gently, "yes. God knows I don't blame you, but would giving up those ships really save enough colonists to justify dropping them from your order of battle?"
"No," she said. "It's just knowing what those fucking bugs are going to do."
She broke off with a shudder she would have let no other member of her staff see, and his mouth tightened. 40 years had passed since the demands of their service careers terminated their academy affair. He didn't know if anyone suspected they'd once been lovers, and it wouldn't have mattered to him if they had. But at this moment, a tiny, ignoble part of him wished he knew Vanessa less well. She needed someone with whom to share her inner strain, and in many ways he was honored to be that someone. Yet in at least one way he was just like any one of her other officers. His own desperate fear needed the rock-like strength she radiated in public, and knowing how savagely her responsibilities were wounding her, frightened him. She looked so delicate. Bird-boned, his mother had called her the time she came home with him for a visit. He knew better than most that appearances could be deceiving, but how in God's name could the determination to meet something like this be packed into such a frail-looking package?
"They aren't really insects, you know," he said as lightly as he could. I know it's tempting to reach for a Terran analog. Even the xenologists did that when they tagged them as arachnids. But if you start ascribing insect behavior to them...
They're bugs, she said flatly. His eyes flicked back up to her face in surprise at the cold, vicious hatred in her voice. They're not Orions, not even Tangri. They're filthy, vile, crawling bugs, and we are by God going to exterminate them like the vermin they are.
Vanessa, he began, but she cut him off with a bark of laughter.
Don't worry, I'm not losing it yet, Marcus. But I mean it, there won't be any treaties after this war, not once the Assembly sees the Erebor footage. We're going to dust off General Directive 18, and we're going to wipe these monsters from the face of the universe.
Her cold, flat, absolute certainty sent a shudder through LeBlanc. Intellectually, he knew she was almost certainly right, and his own emotions agreed with her. But hearing so much icy, distilled hatred from Vanessa frightened him, and he cleared his throat.
I never thought you would lose it. I only wish it hadn't landed on you.
If not on me, then on someone else, she said more normally, and shrugged and reached for her own drink. Whoever else it was would still...
The sudden, raucous scream of Cobra's GQ alarm ripped across her voice. She jerked as if she'd just grabbed one end of a live wire, then whirled to her comm terminal. Status, she barked, even before the officer of the watch's image solidified on the screen.
Tsushima!
The stress-flattened word was harsh, and her face tightened.
Simultaneous transit, sir. Plotting makes it...
The woman on the screen paused to consult her plot.
50-plus bandits in a single wave.
Understood. Activate Plan Able.
Yes, sir.
Murakuma released the key and spun away from the terminal, already unsealing her tunic.
Her vac suit closet had opened automatically when the alarm went, and she bounded across the carpeted cabin towards it.
Marcus?
Already gone.
She darted a glance at him and felt a hysterical urge to giggle as he snatched up his boots and headed for the cabin hatch in sock feet.
See you on Flagbridge.
The hatch closed behind him before she could reply, and she reached for her suit, eyes automatically checking the telltales even as her mind reached out to the horde of starships coming to kill her. 60 light cruisers erupted into normal space in a single massive wave. 12 vanished in sprawling boils of plasma as they interpenetrated, and more died under the laser buoy's fury. The bomb-pumped lasers consumed themselves in the instant they fired, stabbing immensely powerful beams straight through electromagnetic shields to shatter armor and hull members. But their programming spread their fire among all the cruisers. They inflicted crippling damage, yet only a handful of intruders actually perished. The wounded, air-streaming survivors paused, searching for enemies, but no one was in range to attack them. They hesitated a moment longer, and then, one by one, headed away from the warp point, and straight into the waiting mines. Savage explosions pocked space as the hunter-killer satellites lunged at them in eye-tearing flares of detonating antimatter. Yet they accomplished their goal.
Vanessa Murakuma's pitiless face was stone as she watched the last enemy cruiser die.
"They're going to break clear of the mine sooner than anticipated,"
McKenna said, and she nodded. It didn't really matter, given the battle plan she'd evolved, but it was fresh proof of the terrifying difference between the beings who'd crewed those ships and humans. Even allowing for the mine's antimatter warheads, the fields hadn't been that heavy. Sarasota hadn't had enough to stop capital ships— But these people, these bugs, hadn't even tried to sweep them normally. What kind of psychology could see the deliberate self-destruction of ships they could have saved, if only for future use, as a reasonable alternative to minor damage to minesweeping capital ships?
It doesn't matter, she said aloud, and looked up from the master plot. How long since we sent Commodore Reichman the alert message?
10 minutes, sir.
Murakuma cocked her head and considered K-45's geometry.
The warp point to Erebor lay below the two leading to Meriwether and Justin, distributed like the points of a right triangle. The distance from the Erebor point to Justin was only 5.5 light hours, 65 hours transit time for her battleships. But the line from Meriwether to Justin formed the triangle's hypotenuse, and Reichman's transports were in Meriwether. Her alert would reach him in 7 hours, but his transports were slow.
They'd need 15 hours just to get back to K-45, then another 80 to reach the Justin warp point. She wasn't worried about their being intercepted in deep space. They were as fast as anything the enemy had, and all they needed to do was stay beyond missile range. But even if Reichman pulled out the instant her warning reached him, he'd still need a minimum of 102 hours to escape to Justin. That defined how long she had to hold the enemy's attention. She had to lead those super dreadnoughts outside their detection range of Reichman and away from the Justin warp point for at least 5 standard days, keeping them in play until she was certain the transports were clear before she could fall back herself. Of course, the bugs were so slow they'd take 100 hours to reach the warp point even on a least time course, but she dared not cut things that close. If anything delayed Reichman in Merryweather, and the bugs reached his exit point first, he and all the evacuees packed aboard his ships would be hopelessly trapped.
"Anything on their battle lines composition?"
"Plotting's on it now," Ling replied.
"So far they make it 42 super dreadnoughts, but they're still coming through. We think the lead element were either augurs or acids, but we're seeing at least some archers in the follow-on waves."
"Any sign of the avalanches yet?"
"No, sir, but we're still not sure we can distinguish them from the augurs."
Murakuma nodded, walked slowly to her command chair, and racked her helmet on its side while she thought.
They wouldn't know anything about the enemy's technology until they managed to stop the bastards and examine their wreckage, but they'd assigned tentative reporting names based on observed armament to some of his classes. The augurs, acids, and avalanches mounted almost pure energy armaments. Analysis suggested the augurs had heavy primary beam outfits, and the acids carried those damned plasma guns. But it was the avalanche and archer-class ships which worried her. The archers were pure missile platforms with massive capital missile batteries, while the avalanches mounted equally heavy capital force beam armaments. The augurs were potentially deadly, since no known defense could stop a primary beam. If they had capital primaries, which hadn't been confirmed but seemed likely, they'd have an effective range of almost 9 light seconds, and they'd punch straight through anything they hit. But they'd also be slow firing, and the ships which mounted them were 40% slower than her slowest unit. The only way they'd get into range of her would be if she let them. No, it was the avalanches, and especially the archers, she had to sweat. And she looked up at McKenna.
"We'll go with Tsushima 6, Leroy."
Her calm voice gave no indication of the tension twisting in her belly, and the chief of staff nodded with matching control.
"Aye, aye, sir. Tsushima 6.
"Have Admiral Waldeck calm me as soon as he has everything in motion."
"Yes, sir."
McKenna turned to begin passing orders, and Vanessa Murakuma watched her repeater plots as her ships deployed.
The fleet moved out through the minefield gap, advancing on the light dots of the enemy at 5% of light speed. The fleet knew nothing about this warp junction's astrography. Its ships were slower than its enemies, and by now it knew about many of the enemy's technological advantages. But that didn't matter. It had the firepower to crush him, and for all his superior speed, he had only 2 choices. Engage it, or abandon the Nexus without a fight. The oncoming super-dreadnoughts would settle for either.
"All right, Demosthenes," Vanessa Murakuma said quietly to the face on her plot.
"Let's do this right the first time."
"Agreed." Her battle-line commander bared his teeth. "Husak is coming up on her firing position now."
"Good."
Murakuma nodded to the pickup, then turned back to her plot and made herself keep her mouth shut as TF-59 executed Tsushima 6.
She'd split her force into 2 task groups, 59.1 under Jackson Teller, who commanded her carriers and their screen from the battlecruiser Sorcerer, and 59.2, the battle line units, under Waldeck in the battleship Pit Viper. Delegating authority had always been hard for her, and it was even harder when so much depended on the execution of her battle plan. Yet she had no choice. She might hold overall command, but it was Jackson's and Demosthenes' job to execute her plan while she monitored and adjusted for anything that went wrong. And if she yielded to her penchant for backseat driving, it would only make them think she questioned their competence. Rear Admiral Jennifer Husak's 2 battle groups of Dunkirk-class battlecruisers were TFN-59's rearmost units,
trailing astern of the battle line as it fell steadily back before the advancing super-dreadnoughts, leading them away from the Justin warp point. The Dunkirks were smaller and more lightly protected than battleships, but they were Murakuma's long-range snipers, with heavy capital missile batteries, and despite their smaller size, their superior data link meant they could actually throw heavier salvos than the missile-armed SDs. Plotting's analysis was tentative, but it suggested that the opposing archers outnumbered them by at least 50%. That was an awesome edge in launchers, but she didn't expect Husak to take out the enemy all alone. Hurt him, yes. That much she expected, but Husak's real purpose was to positively identify the missile ships by drawing their return fire. "All right," she said quietly as the rain from the Dunkirks to the enemy fell. "Let's see what these bastards have."
"Coming into extreme range now," Commander Trang said.
"Stand by." Jennifer Husak watched her display intently as TFNS Endymion's tactical officer made his tense announcement.
"Good luck, sir," Trang added, and Husak's lips quirked in a humorless smile.
Trang wanted to open fire now, as soon as his internal launchers had the range, and she didn't blame him. Her 12 ships were a preposterously frail force against 70-plus super-dreadnoughts, and any intellectual awareness of superior technology ran a poor second to visceral awareness of the odds. On the other hand, the enemy had yet to demonstrate any equivalent of the missiles she was about to fire at him. Only a handful of the Terran ships he'd yet engaged had carried strategic bombardment missiles, and none had really had the chance to use them as doctrine dictated. But Husak was about to change that. Each SBM ate up 25% more magazine space than a regular capital missile, so Terran ships never carried pure loads of them, and Sarasota had had too few in stores to provide Husak's ships with full loadouts. But she intended to make best use of the ones she had. Their poorer ECM made them easier point defense targets than capital missiles, but they had a full 5 light seconds more range, and Trang wanted to use it all. But one of Husak's objectives was to confirm whether or not the enemy had the weapon, which meant she had to make sure she was well within its envelope. Besides, every light second she closed gave her birds a better chance of scoring.
18 light seconds, Trang said. More endless seconds crept away as the two forces continued to close. 17. We're in range for the external bird, sir.
Let the range fall to 16 light seconds, Husak said softly.
Murakuma chewed her lower lip.
It was hard to believe the bugs didn't have the SBM. Yet Husak was 3 full light seconds inside its range, and not a shot had been fired. If the bugs didn't have the weapon now, it shouldn't take someone with their evident tech capability long to develop it once it was used on them. But in the meantime...
16 light seconds, Trang said flatly, and Husak nodded.
Hold us at this range, Helm, she said.
Engage the enemy, Commander Trang.
12 battlecruisers sent 164 missiles slashing through space as both battlegroups flushed their external racks and opened up with their internal launchers as well. Not a single shot replied, and Jennifer Husak's eyes glowed with hellish delight. That answers one question. If the bad guys had them, they'd sure as hell use them now. Her eyes blazed still brighter as the massive opening salvos roared down on just 2 SDs, and countermissiles began to explode. The bastard's early-generation data link left each of those ships on its own against the incoming fighter, but no single ship could stop those salvos, and a snarl ran around Endymion's flag bridge as they struck. The fireballs were eye-watering, even at this range, but Husak refused to look away, and when the glare died, both of her targets had vanished.
2 down, someone said, and the Admiral nodded.
Let's add to that, she said grimly. Make them count as long as they last, Commander.
The fleet ground steadily onward, despite the missiles battering it from beyond its own range. The enemy battlecruiser's first salvos had exhausted their external ordnance, and the follow-on broadsides were 30% lighter. But they continued their deliberate pounding in overpowering waves of thunder that smashed through all active defenses by sheer weight of numbers. Shields flared and died. Shattered armor fumed away in vapor.
Skeins of atmosphere trailed behind, and some ships fell out of formation with damaged drives. They could have fallen back. No enemy was in range to prevent them, but each wounded Leviathan simply kept coming. No ship could stand more than three of those devastating salvos, but each targeted ship made the enemy expend those missiles upon it.
SBMs are running dry, sir, Trang said tautly. We've got two more salvos, then we're down to CMs.
Confirmed kills, Husak demanded.
We make it eight with two more badly damaged. We think they were all archers, but our ID criteria are pretty tentative. Until they return fire, we can't positively identify them.
Understood. Husak watched the last two SBM salvos roar from her internal launchers. The enemy continued to advance, accepting the slaughter she'd wreaked on him without flinching, and a primitive corner of her mind gibbered that nothing should wade into such fire when it couldn't even shoot back. It was like fighting the insensate violence of a hurricane, not living, thinking beings, and that primitive part of her whispered they were an unstoppable force of nature. But it was only a tiny part, and she bared her teeth. All right, Li Dong, phase two.
Admiral Husak's exhausted her SBMs, Demosthenes Waldeck announced from Murakuma's comm screen. She's closing to capital missile range now.
Understood.
Murakuma turned to Ling Tian.
Warn plotting. They'll be returning fire shortly, and I want every one of those archers fingerprinted the instant it opens up.
The battlecruisers began to close once more. They were entering the fleet's reach now, and targeting systems watched them come.
15 light seconds, Trang reported. Coming into missile launch, multiple hostile launches, 120-plus inbound. Impact in 2.7 seconds from mark.
Return fire, Husak snapped, and locked her command chair shock frame as the enemy's missiles scorched towards her. The bastards had taken a page from her own book and concentrated all their fire on a single target. They obviously couldn't tell her Thetis-class command ships from the Dunkirks, or perhaps they didn't realize there was any difference to look for. If they didn't have command data link, then they had no way to know only a single ship in each battle group mounted the master systems that tied them together. Yet what they knew or didn't know made no difference to TFNS Gerben, as she watched the ship go to violent evasive action. But unlike Husak's targets, Gerben wasn't alone against the storm. Endymion's data net wove a deadly, fine-meshed net of warheads and spitting lasers, ripping the incoming missiles apart, and the enemy's cruder command and control systems split his fire into smaller salvos that couldn't saturate the battlegroup's defenses. Point defense stopped 95% of the incoming fire short of Gibbon, yet simple probability theory said at least some birds had to get through, and the battlecruiser heaved as they wiped away her shields and tore at her armor. Husak's fists clenched as damage reports chattered over the net, and her face was grim. They'd done well to stop that many incoming, but well or not, another exchange like that would blow the ship apart, and she had only 12 ships. "Hit the bastards!" she snarled, and Endymion bucked as she threw fresh fury at her foes. "Gibbon's been hit hard, sir," Commander Ling said,
and Murakuma nodded curtly.
Battlecruisers were too light to face SDs, however superior their data link, but she had no choice. The Dunkirks and Thetises were the only CM-armed ships she had. They had to engage the archers and be engaged in return, if only to identify the missile ships for her. "IDs on the archers?" Her voice was flat, and Ling nodded. "Tracking is confident, sir. Two more salvos and we'll have them nailed."
The super dreadnoughts shuddered under the battlecruiser's fire, but the odds were evening. Even with the enemy's heavier salvos and more destructive warheads, he needed 3 salvos to guarantee a kill. But the fleet's projections indicated that each battlecruiser could survive no more than 2 like the last one. Another super dreadnought vanished in an expanding ball of fire. But the enemy had an iron lock on Gerben, and this time the other SDs flushed their external racks in support. The battlegroup's point defense performed brilliantly, but 3 more missiles got through. Men and women died as concussion and flame and radiation came for them,
Atmosphere streamed from breached plating, and Jennifer Husak's voice was harsh. "Get her out of it, Li Dong!" Orders flashed over the net, and Gubin turned away. She'd lost an engine room, but she was still twice as fast as the oncoming super dreadnoughts. She swung away from them, fleeing their fire, and their targeting systems shifted to her sisters.
"Gubin's breaking off," Waldeck said. "Looks like they're shifting to Nevada. But Husak took out another of them first."
"Understood."
Murakuma watched the wounded battlecruiser accelerate clear of the bug's envelope.
But even as a part of her cheered the ship's survival, another cursed bitterly. If only she had a few missile SDs of her own. The battlecruisers were fighting magnificently, but their superior systems were overmatched by their opponents' sheer toughness. The archers were still dying, yet Gerben's withdrawal diluted the weight of her battle group's next salvo, and the effectiveness of its point defense by a sixth.
"Instruct Admiral Teller to launch his strike," she said.
"Launch." 12 light carriers twitched as mass drivers hurled fighters through their drive fields and into space. 216 small, deadly craft, heavy with external ordnance, curved up and away at point 2C, shaking down into formation, turning for the enemy, and Commander Anson Oliveira watched the continuous tactical update spill across his command fighter's display. Admiral Husak was taking a fearful pounding. Her own battle group was down to only 3 ships and falling back behind its consorts, but only 5 confirmed and 1 possible archer remained.
"Target destination." His strain-flattened voice was clipped as he tapped keys on his console.
"Paired group strikes. Commander Rehnquist has Archer 1, Slattery takes 2, Sung takes 3, and Takagumi and Marker take 4 and 5. We'll take the last 2 strike groups in to clean up the survivors ourselves. Confirm input."
"My board confirms,"
his TAC officer called back, and Oliveira switched to the central net. Sweat beaded his hewn granite face, but he made his words come out even, almost jovial. "Go get 'em, boys and girls. Last one back to the barn buys the beer." The fighters swept past Husak's battered battlecruisers. The Dunkirk's magazines were down to 30%, and her own group had been gutted. All its ships survived, but Gubin, Nevada, Barham, and Jean Bart had been driven out of action with heavy damage. Yet the enemy's concentration on only one of her battlegroups was the first real mistake he'd made. He'd crippled one of them, but the second was untouched.
"Pass tactical command to Commodore Sushien."
Her voice was vicious with mingled loss and satisfaction as she watched the fighters. "Tell him the force advantage is about to shift."
Targeting priorities changed as the small fleet craft hurtled into the fleet's midst. They were fast and agile, squirming in wild evasion maneuvers even as they lined up on their targets. But a hurricane of close-in fire met them. One died, then another, 2 more, a fifth. Dozens of fireballs glared as point defense lasers or force beams or missiles ripped into them. But still they came on, charging into the teeth of their own destruction. They tore into the missile SDs like demons, spitting deadly quartets of short-ranged missiles, and scores of antimatter warheads erupted against shuddering shields and the alloy they protected. Banshee howls of triumph erupted from the speakers as Teller's flagship relayed his strike group's voice telemetry to Cobra. Those howls and the fireballs that spawned them were 30 seconds old by the time Vanessa Murakuma heard and saw them, and she clenched her jaw as all too many jubilant shouts chopped off in sudden silence. Of the 200-plus fighters she'd committed, only 170 fell back on their carriers, but they'd done their job. All remaining archers and 2 suspected avalanches were gone, and despite the anguish of her own losses, her brain ticked smoothly, efficiently, within its protective cocoon of professionalism. So far, she'd lost only 4 badly damaged battlecruisers and 52 fighters to kill 60 light cruisers and 17 super dreadnoughts. That outmassed her entire task force, but the bastards were still coming, and a shudder very like the one Jennifer Husak had felt coursed through her. How in God's name could anything keep coming after a pounding like that? But they were coming, and they had 58 SDs left.
The surviving battlecruisers, unopposed now by any capital missile, closed to the very edge of the standard missile envelope, battering their enemies. But their magazines had to be almost dry, and she might well need them even more later. She looked at her link to Pit Viper. "Have Husak fall back to the colliers and re-ammunition, Demosthenes."
"Yes, sir."
"Once she's clear, move the battle line into extreme missile range. It's our turn to have a go at the bastards."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Waldeck's voice was taut, but there was savage satisfaction in it as well.
And Murakuma nodded with a grim smile.
"All right, you fuckers," she thought coldly. "We've pulled your missile ship's teeth. Try bringing your goddamned energy armaments into range now."
Rear Admiral Vanessa Murakuma crossed her legs and leaned back in her command chair as 12 battleships of the Terran Federation Navy advanced against their overpowering foe. Chapter 8. Options and Obligations.
Major General Xavier Servais looked up as Colonel Mondesi entered the compartment. The colonel's great-great-grandparents had migrated from the island of Haiti to the fringe world of Christoph, and his face was the color of obsidian, and utterly expressionless, which Servais thought, as he stood behind his desk, meant Mondesi had already heard about his orders. "Colonel," Servais offered his hand, and the younger man clasped it firmly.
"Sit, please."
Servais gestured at a chair and waited until Mondesi obeyed his polite command before he reseated himself. He pulled a pipe from his pocket and took his time stuffing it. It was an archaic affectation, but he sometimes found it a useful bit of stage dressing, and he used the delay to study Mondesi. He liked what he saw. The colonel had posted a superb record in the specialized world of the Marines Raiders, and despite whatever he'd already heard, he returned the general's measuring gaze levelly. That argued for more than his fair share of intestinal fortitude, and he was going to need all of that he had. "I wanted to see you to discuss a special operation, Colonel," Servais said once he had his lit pipe drawing. "We're calling the overall plan Redemption, and you've been tapped to command one component of it, Operation Citadel. The good news is, such as it is, that you're being breveted to brigadier for the op. But I won't sugarcoat things. The odds of your living long enough to have the rank confirmed aren't good." He paused for Mondesi's reaction, but the colonel simply nodded and said, "May I ask what this operation will consist of, sir?"
"You may."
Servais leaned back, caressing the polished bowl of his pipe with one hand. "Now that the enemy,
the bugs, as Admiral Murakuma calls them,
have K-45, it's only a matter of time until they hit Justin. The fleet hurt them badly, but they got in their own licks, and the Admiral's staff estimates we have no more than 3 weeks before they resume the advance." Rafael Mondesi nodded again. Most space battles were both violent and brief. When fleets threw antimatter warheads at one another, it seldom took long for the weaker side to be annihilated or run. But the Battle of K-45 had been different. TF-59 had done what it set out to do and mauled the enemy brutally, but at a price. With the archers eliminated, TG-59.2's battleship's superior data link had let them hold their own, but their mixed missile and force beam batteries had compelled them to come into range of the enemy's Avalanche-class SDs. They'd learned the hard way that the acids did in fact mount missile launchers to back their plasma batteries, but their salvos had been too light to break through Murakuma's point defense, and the only bug energy weapon with the range to reach her had been the Avalanche's force beams. She'd taken a pounding from those beams, but she'd ignored the acids and coordinated the fire of her battle line's shipboard weapons with strikes by carefully hoarded fighters to pick off as many Avalanches as possible, then broken off. But this time it hadn't been to withdraw. She disengaged just long enough to carry out emergency repairs to her own ships, then resumed the action. No one had ever seen a battle like it.
For 5 full days, Vanessa Murakuma had played matador, smashing away at her overwhelming opponents with ever-dwindling numbers, drawing them ever further from her exit warp point. She'd battered ship after ship into wreckage, and as each mangled hulk fell out of formation, her surviving fighters pounced upon it and finished it off.
She and Demosthenes Waldeck had reorganized their battle groups on the fly, mixing and matching as damage drove individual units out of action, pulling out ships with empty magazines to race back to the colliers and re-ammunition. Damage control crews had labored till they dropped, fighting the mounting tide of crippled systems, and not a single unit of her own battle line had escaped unhurt. When she finally disengaged for good, she'd lost 80% of her fighters, a battleship, 3 battle cruisers, 2 heavy cruisers, and 5 destroyers, with 8 more capital ships, including the battleships Conquistador and Eros, so damaged they'd barely been able to limp back to Sarasota. But she'd destroyed 53 super dreadnoughts first. It was by any measure the most one-sided victory in naval history, and it hadn't changed a thing. For yet another wave of bug capital ships had entered K-45, even as Murakuma disengaged. Her superior speed had let her break contact, preventing the bugs from tracking her to her exit warp point, so they'd have to find it the hard way. But when they did...
"I understand, sir," the colonel said. "May I assume Citadel has something to do with what happens when they do arrive?"
"You may." Servais' voice was much grimmer than before.
"In the absence of direct divine intervention, they're going to push us out of Justin. We managed to evacuate 85% of the Meriwether colonists, but that left over 1 million behind. And while the transit time from Justin A to Sarasota is less than 20% that from Meriwether to Sarasota, there are 4 times as many people in that system, and we've got, at best, 1 month. That means we're going to have to leave at least 9 million more people behind."
Admiral Murakuma feels, and I agree,
that we cannot simply write those people off. And that's where you come in.
He pinched the bridge of his nose, then sighed. "I don't like last-man battles," he said, "but that's exactly what this war is going to demand. We can't negotiate civilian surrenders because we don't have the least idea how to communicate with these bugs. And judging by the Erebor transmissions, there's no point trying to figure it out.
They see us as food sources, Colonel. All we can do is give them the worst case of bellyache they ever had. And civilians don't have the training or the firepower for that."
"But Marines do," Mondesi said.
"Marines do," Servais confirmed. Their eyes met for a long, silent moment, and then the colonel nodded once again.
"What's the plan, sir?" he asked quietly.
"We'll concentrate on evacuating Justin A."
Servais activated a holo display of the Justin binary system above his desk.
Justin and Harrison, the 3rd and 4th planets of Component A flashed as he named them, have much larger populations than Clements.
Justin B2 lit in turn.
And with the Sarasota warp point associated with Justin A, the transit time is 70 hours shorter.
Admiral Murakuma's already instructed Clements to shut down all emissions and go bush.
There are less than 1 million people on the entire planet, scattered around in very small settlements, so they may be able to conceal their presence from anything but a very close scan. But we can't do that for Justin A, so Admiral Eusebio sent up every rifle, mortar, and HVM he can find. Your job, Colonel, is to distribute those weapons to the civilians of Justin and Harrison. I've already contacted General Merman, the System Peace Force CO, and we're organizing quickie classes to bring his people up to speed on frontline equipment. We're also combing out our Marine contingents, and I estimate we can give you the equivalent of a light division.
Servais paused, looking into Mondesi's steady eyes, and raised one hand, palm uppermost.
"Even with the peace forces to back you, a light division could never stand off an invasion, Colonel. But that isn't your job. The Navy's going to reinforce as quickly as possible, and it's our intention to retake Justin at the earliest possible moment. I wish I could tell you how soon that will be. I can't. All I can tell you is that it's your job to organize and lead a guerrilla resistance for as long as you can, hopefully until we can retake the system.
In the meantime, Admiral Murakuma's staff is organizing a plan for redemption,
a raid to be launched in the event the bugs offer us an opportunity to mount it. They will designate refuge areas, landing zones from which we will attempt to lift out anyone we can if we're able to fight our way back in, even temporarily. But don't count on that happening. The grim-voiced general held the colonel's gaze and spoke very quietly. "I have never before sent an officer into a situation in which I expected him to die, Colonel Mondesi. In this case, however, I have no choice but to do precisely that."
"Admiral Murakuma truly thinks she may be able to relieve you."
"I believe she'll make every humanly possible effort to do just that. But I expect her to fail. Which means you and all your people will be on your own. I won't insult you or them by pretending otherwise to stiffen your morale. I will simply remind you that you are Marines, and that you will be defending 9 million civilians." Servais stood and held out a data chip to the officer he'd just condemned to death. "Your official orders and full data on Justin and Harrison are on the chip. Under the circumstances, the least I can do is give you complete freedom in planning your own operations. Anything my staff and I can do to assist you is yours for the asking."
"Yes, sir."
Mondesi slipped the chip into his pocket. "We'll remember we're Marines, General," he said. "I never doubted it, Colonel." Servais extended his hand once more, and Mondesi gripped it as firmly as he had when he first entered the compartment. "God bless, Colonel," the general said very quietly, and Mondesi nodded, released his hand, and walked through the hatch. Captain Andrew Foote Prescott of the battlecruiser Daikyu came to attention as the delicate, red-haired woman by the holotank straightened and turned to face him. Her black-and-silver uniform set off her coloring with a perfection any HD producer would have killed for, and she stood tall and straight, but there were lines of strain on her oval face. "Captain Prescott." Prescott was of only average height and build, yet he found himself taking the hand she extended gingerly, as if he feared a firm grip would shatter the fragile bones. The skin around her weary eyes crinkled, and a faint smile dimpled her cheeks, as if she was used to the reaction, but she squeezed hard. "Admiral," he said, and found himself smiling back. For all her fatigue and obvious strain, this woman still radiated an indefinable serenity and a very definable aura of command. "Thank you for coming so promptly," she said, and gestured at the tank. "Have a look." He quirked an eyebrow, then stepped closer to the tank. It held a small-scale display of the Justin system, centered on the F-8 furnace of Justin A. Justin B, its G-0 companion, lay the better part of 5 light-hours distant, barely visible at the edge of the tank. But what caught his eye were 5 crimson dots scattered about the Justin B asteroid belt at its closest approach to Justin A. Justin B, its G-0 companion, lay the better part of 5 light-hours distant, barely visible at the edge of the tank. But what caught his eye were 5 crimson dots scattered about the Justin B asteroid belt at its closest approach to Justin A. He gazed at them for a moment, then looked inquiringly at his admiral. "Those are, or shortly will be, the locations of hidden supply ships, Captain. Yours." "Mine, sir?" "Yours," she repeated. She pointed at a chair and folded her hands behind her to consider him as he slid into it and laid his cap on the table. The Prescott family had served the fleet well. It ought to have, for naval service was bred into its bone and blood. A Prescott had served Prince Rupert of Bohemia aboard the Royal James at the 4 Days Battle. Others had died on the decks of the brig Lawrence in the Battle of Lake Erie and the Cumberland at Hampton Roads, and yet another had sailed into Manila Bay aboard the cruiser Olympia. His grandson had flown from the deck of the carrier Yorktown at the Battle of Midway, and when the Federated Government of Earth merged the old national militaries, the Prescotts had taken their tradition into the Federation's Navy.
Murakuma was only the 3rd member of her family to don naval uniform,
but this man's naval lineage stretched back for over 6 standard centuries. That was one reason she'd chosen him, and she could almost feel his ancestors' silent presence at his shoulder as he looked calmly back at her. "I intend to hold this system if at all possible, Captain," she said finally. "I think I have a chance to do so, but it isn't a good one. Whatever we do to these creatures, they simply keep on coming, and without reinforcements—" She shrugged, and Prescott nodded. This woman had just won one of the greatest naval victories in history.
Some officers in her position would have hidden their fears for the future behind pride in the past, but Vanessa Murakuma didn't.
and her composure and frankness to a relatively junior captain impressed him. "Because it seems likely we will, in fact, fail to hold Justin," she went on. "It is incumbent upon me to plan for the worst. That's where you come in." She took one hand from behind her back to gesture at the hollow tank. "We're going to leave a lot of civilians behind, and the decision to withdraw will be mine. I, Captain Prescott, will personally sentence 9 million human beings to death." He opened his mouth to dispute her cruel self-accusation, but she shook her head. "No, Captain. I realize I'll have no choice, and my orders from the Admiralty are clear. The Justinians must be considered expendable, and I am specifically forbidden to risk the destruction of my command to save them. But I also intend to move heaven and hell to get as many of them out as possible. Perhaps it's only a sop to my conscience or a whimsical gesture, but I will not sacrifice a single human being I can save to these monsters, whatever my orders." Prescott stiffened in his chair as bared steel clashed behind her serenity, and her exhausted eyes flickered with a hard, dangerous light. "I want you to understand something, Captain Prescott," she said softly. "What I intend to do could be construed as a violation of my own orders from Sky Marshal Avrin. I cannot order you to accept the responsibility I'm about to ask you to shoulder. I can only ask you to volunteer, and if you do so, your chance to succeed, or survive, will be slight." "What precisely do you want me to volunteer for, sir?" Prescott asked in a level voice. "I'm asking you to accept an extremely hazardous assignment." She folded both hands behind her once more and looked into his eyes. "Your ship's a broadsword class, with cloaking ECM. If and when we're forced to withdraw, I want to detach Daikyu as part of a scouting force which will remain in Justin to observe the enemy." "To what purpose, Admiral?" Prescott asked after a moment. "It will be some time before Battlefleet can reinforce us sufficiently to take the offensive. It is remotely possible, however, that before that time comes, the chance to raid Justin from Sarasota will arise. My staff is currently planning for just such an operation under the codename Redemption, but we've come up against one problem again and again. For an inferior force to raid a superior one, it must have accurate information on its enemy's strength and deployments." "I see." Prescott looked down at his cap for a moment, stroking its braided visor with a forefinger, then looked back up at his admiral. "I can think of several difficulties, sir," he said calmly, "but I'm sure we can figure out a way around most of them if we put our minds to it."
Chapter 9. They Just Keep Coming. It was late as Vanessa Murakuma prowled Flagbridge. She ought to be in bed. Her wakefulness and inability to sit still only advertised her edginess and might well shake her subordinate's nerve. But she couldn't help it. It was harder each day to project the composure and certainty her personnel needed, and her ignorance of the bug's activities only made it worse. She wheeled back to the master plot and glowered into it. Each of the 22 days since the Battle of K-45 had added its weight to her millstone tension, yet each had also been a priceless treasure. Sarasota had done wonders with the ships she'd sent back to it, and a few desperately needed reinforcements had arrived as well, headed by 5 fleet carriers and 3 Matterhorn missile SDs. But she was grimly certain the bugs had been reinforced even more heavily. Certain, yet unable to confirm it. She'd tried sneaking pinnaces through to K-45, but the cost had been too high. Over 80% had been picked off before they could reverse course and escape. Volunteers continued to come forward, but there was no possible way to justify sacrificing them, particularly when she knew the enemy was heavily equipped with cloaking ECM. Enough of her people were going to die when the bugs finally attacked. She wouldn't send them to their deaths in efforts to spy on an enemy who could hide so much of his strength anyway. Perhaps another admiral could have done it. Perhaps would even have been justified in the cold, brutal math of war. She couldn't, yet the strain of waiting in ignorance twisted her nerves, and her nights were haunted by nightmares whose existence she dared admit to no one, even Marcus, though she suspected Cobra's chief surgeon guessed. He hadn't argued when she finally went to him to demand something to help her sleep, at any rate. It wasn't her fault. She knew that.
and she'd tried to accept that lack of options absolved her from guilt. But she'd learned more about herself in the last 3 months than in all her previous 67 years, and there was a flaw at her core, the very one she knew now which had sent her into uniform in the first place. Responsibility. It was her job to protect civilians.